Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Unsung heroes. Unsung heroes. Unsung heroes. Unsung heroes.
Hi, this is Ricky Wilde. Welcome to Unsung Heroes. This week we've got a fabulous guest, Tony Swain. What a legend that guy is.
Yeah. It was a lovely interview, Ricky, I must say. We were sat in your studio.
Yeah.
You obviously know Tony. You go back quite a way. And
yeah,
you could
we
really
did.
Feel
yeah.
that sitting in a room. It was just a really chilled out, relaxed vibe. And I think your listeners are going to enjoy it.
Tony's an incredible talent. He wrote and produced loads of hits for Bananarama, Alison Moyet, Mariah Carey. Mariah Carey sampled a track called Just an Illusion that he wrote for a band called Imagination back in the 80s.
Wasn't it?
And Mariah Carey sampled it on her most successful album.
Well, listen, he goes on to talk about that. He mentions that. And
that's a great story.
Yeah.
But he's written like for, Imagination, Body Talk, Flashback. What a talent, what a talent. And I was lucky enough to work with Tony back in 83, 84, I think it was. And we co-produced one of Kim's albums called Close. And we had, quite a few hits off that album. I've got some lovely memories of that. He's one of the sods as well. That we've talked about before.
Yeah.
Society of Distinguished Songwriters.
Can I just ask, Ricky, what's the remit of being invited into the sods? Is it, do you get to be invited in, or can you apply, or what's...
Basically, we have like three stag do's and then a ladies' night at the end of the year. And each stag do, someone will propose a writer, and whoever's there on the night will decide, we put it to a vote.
Oh, everyone gets a vote.
Everyone gets a vote. And it goes into a hat. If you've got the majority, then you're invited to be a member.
Wow.
And so, there's been a few names that have been brought up. But I thought, definitely they're legends.
Mm.
And they've been voted out. And it's kind of like, wow.
Do you think it's because people got personal things with them?
It can be.
You never know what's going on.
You don't know why, mate. You don't know why. I mean, some of the names that I've heard proposed that have been turned down, I've been absolutely flabbergasted.
Really? That would be a good podcast, that, Ricky.
Yeah, and then it makes you realise how lucky you are to be in there. You know what I mean? It's like, God, if he gets voted out, how did I get in?
Now, listen, and the wife, Alison, been very lucky to have been invited to one of the ladies' nights. And I think it was as a result of that, Rick, to be honest, the idea of a podcast came about, didn't it?
Yeah.
So what happens in ladies' night? Everyone gets up and performs the songs that they've written.
Well, it's a unique evening because when you get people like Richard Kirk getting up, who wrote Mandy.
Yeah.
I mean, what a beautiful song. It's a classic song. And
he sang that the night we were there. And
how amazing
you just
was
could
that?
Not buy that kind of performance in a room or that amount of talent in one room.
Unbelievable. Yeah, some and of Les the songs Reed, have, bless him, God rest
Well, that was
soul.
What we talked about at the time when Les was there. Les performed.
Hush, what a tune.
Very sadly died quite soon afterwards.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And I said to you at that time, Rick, didn't I? I said, we've got to document these guys. You know, they're not getting any younger. They've got fantastic stories, fantastic history. Yeah. And I think if we're doing nothing else here with this podcast, we're documenting the history of these guys and getting it all down on for people to listen to. And I think that's a really important thing.
And some of the stories these guys have got, and some of the songs they've written, and everybody knows them, but they don't know the guys behind it.
Well, that's exactly why the Unsung Heroes come about,
exactly.
Wasn't it? Yeah, because literally, yeah, I was there. You would know them all, Ricky, but I wouldn't.
Yeah.
And yeah, literally in a room full of people that I didn't recognise at all.
No.
You would walk past them in the street, or if you in Morrison's, you'd walk past them, wouldn't you, in the supermarket?
Yeah.
But as soon as they get down and start playing the piano, you think, fucking hell, what? That's a tune.
But also all the people that these guys have worked with, all the legends of the industry over the years, and, they've it's right the way through from the bloody 50s through to now.
Yeah, and actually a lot of the artists as well owe their careers to these guys.
Absolutely.
You know, these are the guys
absolutely
that are sort of the engine room. They're in the engine room, they're sort of there. And it's when you really get a sense that if an artist isn't writing his own music and producing it and he's just the front man, he's nothing without these guys back writing all these great tunes for them.
In this day and age, most of the artists write their own tunes, but back in the 50s and 60s, I think you found that a lot of the artists didn't, like Tom Jones, Elvis Presley, actually.
Frank Sinatra.
They didn't write their own songs, and they needed these guys to come up with these amazing tunes, and that's how it was in those days. It was kind of like you were a writer, and that was your job, and then there'd be an artist, and that was their job.
But very clearly defined,
it really was. And these guys, they were so talented, and these beautiful, stunning songs. But you're right, Jake, they needed to be documented, to the story as to where they came from and what inspired them.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what we've done here with Tony Swain.
Yeah.
As you said, you've worked with him years ago, lovely guy. First time I met him.
Yeah.
And it was just the three of us sitting in a room. And
again, what fantastic stories Tony's got as well. So,
well, let's hear him.
But yeah, let's hear him.
Tony Swain.
And here we are with Mr. Tony Swain.
Hello.
How are you, mate?
I am fine.
First of all, thank you for coming. It's lovely to have you here.
It's a pleasure to see you on this rather horrible, rainy day.
It's not very nice.
You're a ray of sunshine, Rick. And you, Jake, of course.
Thank you.
So let me first explain to you what this is all about. This is it's a podcast called Unsung Heroes.
Right.
And it's basically, I just want to celebrate people behind the scenes in the music industry, like lighting guys, sound guys, engineers, art directors, choreographers, movers and shakers, songwriters, people like yourself, Tony.
Right.
The people that make the magic. And you are certainly one of those people, Tony.
Well, thank you.
I've had the great pleasure of working with you when we did the Close album back
absolutely
in 84. Six,
I think. Making that album with you was a great experience, and Kim, of course, and we just, not all albums are a happy event, you even if they're successful or anything, you can spend a year in the studio and sometimes you think you made a great album and it doesn't connect how you want to or anything else, but that was a very good and a fun project to do.
It was, and I think it sounded it.
Yeah.
Up until that point, I hadn't worked with anybody else as a producer. So it was an interesting experience for me, but it was something that I really wanted to embrace. And I was just so happy the way... I knew you before because you'd come into our studio working with Louise Goffin, I think.
Yeah, Carole King's daughter.
That's right, yeah. And so we'd become mates through that, really. And so obviously when it came to the point of working on the Close album, I did feel that I wanted a fresh injection of creative energy, and I thought of you immediately. And it was lovely the way the whole process happened, and I was very grateful that you joined us on that.
It was great because the point is you and I are both musicians, so there was a lot of given, there was like suggestions flying everywhere, and we had problems with some of the tracks and not others. But the outcome, and you are the king of sequences, and the Fairlight and that sort of sound going way back into...
Because that was quite... that was new technology then, wasn't it? The Fairlight 2, I think, we worked on
that's
for
right
that album.
Yeah.
And I remember I'd not had it long, so I was still getting my head around using that and how the capabilities of that particular synth.
Yeah.
And I remember...
and sampling.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. And the thing is, I just remember that the Fairlight was... Did it have Winchester drives or something? Or was that a Synclavier? I can't remember.
It was a Synclavier, that was, yeah.
Everything cost a fortune, didn't it?
Yeah.
I think it was a great machine, but there were some capabilities that it couldn't do. And I remember because we taken up to meet Human League to produce their next album.
Mm.
And in fact, we didn't. And I met Phil and the girls, which is an experience. That's a book in itself. Yeah, I can't tell you. Yeah. And he liked a lot of the work that I'd done on the Imagination albums. And the thing is, and he had to sing clavier. And I remember him, you know, going, you know, what do you think of this? And he played, you know, he just hit a key and he went, keep feeling fascination, the backing vocals. Yeah, and I thought, okay, well, you know, it's good for some things.
But. Yeah. Well, it was the first sampler that came out that was kind of longer than 2 seconds. And you could have like a minute and a half or something like that.
Yeah.
In mono, obviously, not it wasn't even stereo.
No.
And so he had the mono sampler. And so, yeah, so for recording whole choruses and flying them in was an absolute godsend.
We used to fly choruses in, but we did it with the tape because we didn't have it, and we just literally mark the tape up on another machine and just go 1, 2, 3, bang, and then you get the whole chorus. And people went, "What are you doing?"
Yeah.
Well, we said, "Well, we worked out why would we keep singing the same chorus over again, eating up studio time and the vocalists getting worn out when we can just dump it and use the same chorus." And, and people went, "Oh," and then.
Obviously, you had to bear in mind that when you were writing the song, not to have a key change.
Yes, of course. Yeah, well, yeah, because we didn't have the technology for that. But
then you have to record the chorus all over again in the new key,
which
meant you couldn't fly in. So you kind of like...
And in the early days...
Yeah, exactly.
And Duran Duran were recording next door. This is all in Redbus in London. And Colin Thurston, who's sadly not around anymore, he was producing that. And Simon Le Bon was, I think, staying at his house. And Simon was learning his singing trade, I'll put it like that, at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, turned out to be obviously great and everything else. But and Colin came in to the studio to see me, went, "What am I going to do?" You know, like, you know, I told him about, like, put this effect on him, do this and do that.
Yeah,
and there was a lot of exchange of information between people going, you know, Steve Levine was doing Culture Club and he was going, "How do you do that? And what do you do? How do you get that bass drum sound?" And he had all the new instruments and I said, "Oh, can I borrow that?" And, that's what it's like.
Yeah.
Like you and I were always talking about, you know, instruments and that and everything else. And I remember there's an era where there was this like a craze to buy personalised number plates.
That's a very 80s thing to do, that was.
Yeah, and there was, so we were talking about, we were talking about, like, the lexicon, we're talking about in numbers, like, some outboard gear was called the 480XL.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in between, I remember my engineer, Richard, and he go, I say, "Have you seen the 480XL? He says, "What's that, a number plate?" So we were trying to talk about, like, outboard gear, number plates, and I was like, oh, whatever, and cars.
Yeah.
That's all we talked about, cars.
Yeah. Porsches.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
We've touched on that on the other pods we've done, haven't we, in terms of how technology has changed the landscape of songwriting and how much, you know, it's fascinating to hear how it was before. I mean, do you think it's totally... Of course, it's totally changed in the last, you know, 10 years or whatever. It's changing all the time. But do you think it's so much easier now for songwriters?
Totally. I mean, it's interesting you said that because the 80s was, there was such a technical advance because of the sampling, because we couldn't, to play a decent piano sound, you had to play a decent piano. Because the one thing they had problems with was like the bandwidth of this early sampling. And then, you know, so we were all craving for something that would do, like the Fairlight came along and that was groundbreaking really, because it and then Akai made a sampler, the 9000, then the 1000. But the Fairlight still sounded better. And that's what Kim's Close album was made on. It had roundness to it. The Akai didn't have a sort of nice round bottom end, but I've talked about this before somewhere else. The whole 80s was dominated by this, and it was in the records. You can plot it from Peter Gabriel's Monkey, you know, Drop the Monkey, to Thomas Dolby Hyperactive, whatever it's called. Yeah. All the records were changing because of the equipment, and they were sounding very sequenced, very robotic, and everyone got addicted to it. I mean, Skritti Politti, you know, but it's easily marked. And by the end of the 80s, we had everything.
We
had everything. But then someone came along with a computer based on the Atari that, instead of costing 60 grand, this thing did a similar thing for like a grand. And that was it. But all this stuff, you can read that history in the tracks, definitely.
Yeah, you can hear it, can't you?
Yeah. And then we got really crunchy, I think, and then very bright, and then big gated drums. I mean, obviously, Phil Collins' Something in the Air is a great example of that. But it was just the... it was like, oh my God, have you heard that on that? How did they do that? Oh, it's that, so we'll get that in.
Mm.
I did an album. The first track I had success with was Imagination Body Talk, which was a very sort of disco-y dancing, but not sequenced, actually. I played most of the stuff on it, and the bass and all that stuff, which has sort of become a bit of a sort of internet mystery, which I put right, of what it was, you know. And after that album, we were asked to do a remix album. And when nobody was doing any remixes, and I said, really? You want me to go in again? It's like, I've done that, and I don't really want to do it again. And
was it re-recording it, or was it just remixing
it? This was Night Dubbing, an album called Night Dubbing. Now, so the sort of thought about that is, it's easy. You don't have to do anything. We don't have to get the artist in. We don't have to pay anything. This was the record company.
It's just studio time, and that's it.
It's the same tapes, same things, and it's just like making it something else. Well, so we thought, okay, you know. So we hired every piece of equipment that was new and went mad. I mean, I'm talking about going from vary speed in the multi-tracks up and down. There was a thing called the Plubison French thing called Infernal Machine. This could stretch anything like elastic or not, you know. So we ran things at half speed, double speed, did things that had never been done before. We put speakers and we swung expensive microphones over them like this to make it sound mad.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't enjoy really any of it because it was hard work, and I didn't really want to do it. But I just that album went at number 9. I just went, oh my God! And I remember hearing it coming out of cars, and I went, oh my God, because no one had done that really. They'd not taken anything and messed with it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it was another look. And of course, now remixing is just crazy. You know, absolutely crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's an art in itself as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're born in 1952.
Oh. So they say.
So they say.
We talked about that this morning.
Allegedly.
Don't remind me.
And you were born in London, not Stockport, because I said Stockport to Graham Gorman, and he said no.
Shepherd's Bush.
Shepherd's Bush.
Yeah.
Tony, what were your musical influences?
Oh, my goodness. If you look at the chart in the 50s, it was literally Russ Conway, weird stuff. And then, of course, the Beatles came, and I was just transfixed by that thought of what they were doing and what you could do. It wasn't about the drums or the piano, it's what you could do with the tape recorder.
Yeah.
And
so you were fascinated by production at that age?
Yeah, I mean, my sort of upbringing history, my grandfather made radiograms, and a long time ago, one of my ancestors, my great-great-grandfather, was a famous clockmaker, and I've got this sort of, like, weird engineering fascination going on in my brain as well.
Yeah.
So when I was about 17, 18, my parents bought me a Revox. Now, the Revox was a machine made by the same company who makes the analog 24-track, Studer.
Yeah.
And then we bought a 4-track and everything else, and then it went from there.
Yeah.
But I ended up, as you know, working in television.
Yes, you're a cameraman.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And sometime boom operator.
Yeah, sometime. But I went to BBC to do sound, and then I thought, this isn't really that interesting. You know, I want to get behind the cameras, or direct or do something like that. And so I ended up in ATV in Elstree doing filming.
Yeah, because that's where we film at the moment. Yeah, that's where we film EastEnders.
Yeah, well,
they've still got the studio there. I think it's Studio D or something.
That's right.
And they've still got a balcony, you know, where the two Muppets sit and all that.
Stan and Waldorf.
Yeah.
Well, I've got so I know that one. You've got you're on the back lot, aren't you?
That's it.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, so much history in that studio.
But we had the most brilliant time there. I can't even tell you. I mean, I still see people from that era. Mm. It was just fantastic.
And was Tom Jones there at that time?
And we did all the American specials because we were working in colour before BBC. So I saw Gene Kelly do Singing in the Rain in front of my eyes. I saw.
Wow.
I was tracking cameras while Laurence Olivier was doing Merchant of Venice, and he was like here. Barbara Streisand specials, Stevie Wonder, Tina Turner, you know, all these things, John Cleese, you know, but all the guests on the Muppets, they had some incredible guests.
Yeah.
And we did the last time Bing Crosby did White Christmas. Wow. That was me. I shot, you know, with David Bowie doing that.
And that was you. You were behind the camera, were you?
We were doing the cameras, yeah. Oh, yeah. God. So, yeah. I did, of course, you know, I did those when I was six.
Yeah.
You know? I don't start doing the numbers, you know. Jesus Christ.
So, how'd you go from that? Were you writing music
all
in the background?
Time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was signed to. I got a record deal while I was there with Polydor.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, yeah, and that's that. Yeah, so we were in a band, and then all I could think about, even when I was ATV, I love the camera work, I love the whole thing, was music, and that was it. It was just filled my mind all the time. That's really what I wanted to do.
Incredible, because in some ways you had a career there for life, didn't you? You know, especially at that time, BBC, you're sort of BBC staff, you could stay there. And in one sense, your life is kind of going in one direction, but you had this other.
Well, yeah, I had this sort of hankering. Yeah. And of course, we were well paid. There was an opportunity came out. I was 26, which is a bit old to do this. So someone said, they were building a state-of-the-art studio in London called Red Bus, and this was like, you know, beautiful place. Mm. It was no expense spared. And they said, you know, I said, I really want to get in this. And they'd signed us as writers and producers.
Is it signed us? Who was us?
Steve Jolly.
Yeah. And myself. And where did you meet Steve? Did you,
at ATV.
At ATV.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was a boom. He was a sound man. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So
you kind of hit it off musically.
We sort of like, you know, that he wanted to be a singer and a writer. So I went really to Red Bus Studios as a tape op. You know, so I went completely backwards. I took a 2/3 cut in salary, which is difficult because I'd have...
Brave.
And started making tea again, which was difficult. But I had to learn about, you know, how it was... I knew about sort of making things and takes, but I wanted to see professionally how it was done. And the guy who taught me was Jeff Calver. He produced the Walker Brothers, and he was a fantastic engineer.
Yeah.
So...
What did you learn from him, Tom?
Well... I learned how to mic things up, you know, where do you put a mic on a flute? You know, you put it above and odd things, you know.
What mics to use.
Yeah, and how to record orchestras, what are compressors and limiters and reverbs are about and how to use them properly.
So everything, pretty much.
And the problem today is that we've got virtual versions of these things. Yeah. And if you don't know how the real thing works, then you don't really know what you're doing. Although I'm not criticising... You know, young people of today, because they make some great records and they work in a different way. But it's helpful to know what the thing is they're looking at is imitating.
Yes,
I think. But so I learned a lot from him. And then we used the dead time to record what we wanted to do.
Oh, they allowed you to do that, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Which was great. So, and as soon as I went in that control room, a professional control room, I just thought, I want to be here. This is where I belong.
Yeah,
this is where
you found your place. Yeah,
yeah. I want to be in this environment all the time, and I think that was it. But basically, from that, the first hit I had transpired from that situation, you know, which was called Body Talk, which actually started life as something else, as an instrumental, and I put synth bass on it, which I played, and people said to me, "You're mad," you know, like, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "Well, because." I like it, and I think, and it was that sort of gave it a stamp. Mm. But I've never lost my interest in also camera work. I still love video. You know, I did editing, directed some pop videos, and did that. But
did you used to do stuff for your own work, for your own music, or for other people?
Well, so sometimes later on for other people. Because when I had my studios, I invested in Avid stuff and all that rubbish editing stuff. But the thing is that to an extent they go hand in hand. I love, you know, music. Go the correct music on pictures, you know, can make a huge difference. So, but no, I mean, music is my first thing. And the thing is then you feel that when you have a hit, I mean, I remember that going in at 67, and it was the times when it took 18 weeks and it ended up at number 4, and that was it. And then for years and years, we just couldn't do anything wrong. Mm. Other acts came to us, and it just got into like a, you know, it was as if my whole life had been reorientated. Someone went, right, you know, from now on, you're going to have success.
Yeah.
But I'd also been able to call on the 10 years before that we'd been messing around and doing stuff.
But you did a solo thing, didn't you, with Steve, I think?
Yeah.
And that single came out, and I was listening to that, actually. And it sounded very much like Imagination, that bass line. You could see where it all came, where the Imagination stuff came from.
Yeah, exactly.
So where did those ideas come from? What was your inspiration behind those songs?
I think the imagination, the inspiration for that had come, and the way I'd taken this existing track and changed it, was really due. One of the things I listened to Herb Alpert's Rise, which is a great track, which was dun 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 clap. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
They'd slowed it all down to get the tempo down. So instead of 120 BPM, you know, like Night Fever, standard disco thing, they'd gone down to 80-something. So I thought, okay, two can do this. And so we came up with this thing, very simple thing, and then Lee John and Ashley, Lee took it away and wrote the Body Talk lyric on top of it, and then it thing. But the thing is, we only ever made 12-inch versions. So you'd end up with a 12-inch... the best 12-inch, your long version, which would be on the album, and the 12-inch, and then the 7-inch would be derived from that. I mean, Just an Illusion took me 2 days to edit. I thought I was going to go mad.
Oh.
I mean, it took forever, and that was two... But the bass lines took a couple of days, and they were combined down to one bass line. They were the best of the two.
So can you just quickly go run through that bass line? Because that bass sound was very unique to Imagination. Flashback and...
all of them.
Yeah.
And Body Talk,
Flashback, Just an Illusion. Just an Illusion had that same kind of... kind of
Portamento.
Yeah. And you used that quite a lot. And that was so... It's such a distinctive sound.
Yeah.
And I'd not heard that on any bass up until then.
In 1979, Roland... they started to make synthesizers, and this one came from Chiswick near Shepherd's Bush.
Yeah.
It was only monophonic. Monophonic meaning it would only play one note at a time, not a chord.
Yeah.
But it had the slidey switch on it, and I really got my head around this thing.
Yeah.
So in the end, I decided to use this on the Imagination thing. This was 3 or 4 years later.
Yeah.
And I sort of used it on loads of different things. And...
So you were using that purely as the bass, no bass guitars, which I guess up until that point.
And I love the sound. Jive Talking by the Bee Gees was a big hit, and I love this sort of deep bass and that you could get out of a synthesized bass. Yeah. So I thought, great, I can do the bass, I can simulate guitar parts and Fender Rhodes and things, I can do all this, and I can, you know... Which sounds a bit of a control freak.
But I
think I had this vision.
I know, I totally relate to that.
Yeah, of how I could do it. And the point is, the thing was, in the end, is that I decided it sounded a bit plain, although it would do two octaves at a time, which made it fat and cut through on small radio.
Yeah.
But I put a guitar pedal, an SE1 Boss Chorus, and then it ended up in a DBX compressor, like compressed up its own backside.
Yeah.
And this gave it just... And when I mixed it with a guy called Morgan Kahn, who was part of that record label, it was R&B through Red Bus. He was going to the clubs all the time. So he had the ears, you know, for that. And you know, us all saddos, because we didn't have time to go to clubs because we were locked in the studio, or knackered. So he'd come in and go, he sat with me and he went, let's push the bass higher. So when we got the balance on the bass, I put it up like 6 dB higher than you normally would. So it's just like... here.
Yeah.
And that was it. And it didn't have much on it. It had, I think the magic of that was it was synthesizers, Fender Rhodes, great vocals that Lee did, but also an acoustic piano.
I was going to say that the acoustic piano gave that organic element to it, that along with Lee's voice, that's what really made it a lot more heartfelt, I think.
And there's something a bit, I think, you know, I like Michel Legrand as a sort of musician and writer, the French guy. And there was something a bit Frenchy things, which is why I put these strings on the end that went sort of... Da-da,
So
basically, the question you first asked me was about my influences from growing up. And those easy listening influences, the sort of musical tracks or film tracks, this and jazz, it all culminated in, you know, what... I liked, and I love that sort of R&B slow stuff.
Yeah.
And incredibly enough, you know, with Just an Illusion, you know, Mariah Carey sampled
it. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What were your thoughts on that? When was it a sample?
Buy a new car.
Yeah.
Phone Rick up, hang out,
see if we can go out for some soup and a yogurt. Yeah. You know,
Japanese meal for 500 quid a shot. Yeah, no.
Well, I was in a very difficult position because at the time I was, you know, the head of international A&R or consultant for Universal.
Yeah,
she was on Universal on Island Def Jam, and L.A. Reid was A&R in that album. And
that's her most successful album, I think, as well.
8.5 million copies. So
mental, isn't it?
There was crazy. A rumor that she'd used the backtrack, right? There was a rumor, and they said someone come into America said, "I've heard that in the office in America," and I went, "Really? Okay," because I co-wrote it as well as being a producer and playing it all. And the thing is that no one has said anything, though. You know, no one has approached anybody, like the writers or the publishers, about this.
Really?
I was hearing whispers. So I went into the CEO, who's a friend, and I said, "Look, this has put me in a really difficult position. I'm hearing that they've used the track, but nobody's approached me, the publishers or anything." They played it down the phone, and I went, "Oh, yeah, I know. I recognise that." And she'd written a new line on top.
Did you like it straight away? Or?
Yeah, I didn't. I thought, OK, fine, it's Mariah Carey, you know, get your number with L.A. Reid, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And I thought, OK, right. So they said, "Well, we need to clear it." So I said, "What are we talking about here? You know, this is confidential, but it's quite normal." I mean, they said, "Well, we're happy to give you 50%. And I went, "Okay, I think, because with a sample, I know people
come
who...
Come to daddy.
Yeah, yeah. I know people who got 80% for just a little bit of sample."
Yeah.
And I thought, fair enough. Fine, it's a done deal.
Lovely.
Done deal. And I thought it was totally fair. So later on, with my Universal hat on, I just went as a Universal consultant to some plush Soho cinema in the back streets, you know, like private thing, quite big. L.A. Reid came to talk about the album, and it was a big launch for the album.
Yeah.
So somebody, one of the staff, we all went down, and someone introduced and said, "Oh, this is Tony. You know, this is Tony." And he went, "Hi, nice to meet you," you know, like that. And he said, "This is Tony who played the bass on the original." And he went... He went, "Oh my God." He's just like, he went like this to me. And I went, you know, he said, "Love the track." And that was it. I thought, okay, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
You know? And it did really well. It was a single. Amazing. You never know what's around the corner.
Amazing. Well, just after that, Destiny's Child, was it a sample or did they redo it as well?
They sampled it and these, you know, I think PM Dawn sampled it as well. Yeah, they sampled it, Andrew.
I was going to talk to you about that in a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting story.
The several people sampled it and Body Talk, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, so you never know.
No.
You never know. I mean, I had no idea. That was just completely out of the blue. Like, commercials come out of the blue, you know, and the thing is... But
can I ask, who would you have liked to have covered any of your songs but never did?
That's a great question, actually. Well, I think that there are artists I love, you know, Steve Winwood, who I nearly produced the High Love album, but it fell about in negotiation, so I've got the demos. So that was a sad thing. Michael McDonald, who I've worked with, but... you know, it's not likely he would have done any of the songs because they're not suitable. But, yeah, sometimes you get a shock when someone takes your song and you get it back and you go, oh, you know, you it's like, you know, what have they done to it sort of thing. I've had a few of those. But, yeah, I mean, I am a huge Frank Sinatra fan.
Yeah, I love a bit of Frank.
Yeah, yeah. I played him on the way here. You know, it's just I absolutely think he's... And one of our sort, one of the guys in Sots, Tony Hatch, I didn't even know. He produced a whole album with him.
Did he? Wow.
And as soon as I found that out, I said, you know, I quizzed him. And what was it like? What was it like in the studio? What about this? He never came to ATV. I never came on The Muppet Show, unfortunately. Yeah. But,
Sammy Davis did, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. I remember seeing him. Yeah. And he was tiny.
Tiny. Yeah, tiny. Yeah.
He's a great artist.
He's great.
Yeah. Fantastic. And great dancer.
Incredible.
Well. Yeah. John Wayne I saw.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, John Wayne. Yeah, and Glenn Campbell, who notoriously we remember now, he had a radio mic on, and they left it on in D, you know, Jake. And he went to the toilets, and they left it up, and he was going like on a rhinestone cowboy. It was really.
I always get worried about that. Yeah, you always got to switch it off.
Yeah, you've got to be really careful.
So, was there a talk of you might have been working with Madonna at one point?
Yes.
What happened there? Tell us all about that.
Well, that's a great story, isn't it? Oh, my God. She loved the Imagination Records. She yeah. loved them. And so she, at the time about Holiday, I was given the album. Seymour Stein was trying to get hold of us. And he did get hold of us. And I listened to the, which is Jelly Bean.
Yes, Benitez. Yeah.
And basically, I didn't love the album, I'll be honest with you. Mm. And but Holiday was a bit unique.
Yeah.
Well, finally, we got together. The only time I could meet her and she could meet was after that Top of the Pops. And I met her in the hotel room. Yeah. So, and she's tiny, and a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And she played all the demos and, it was like nice meeting and we got on and everything else. And she said, right, when can you do it? You know, when can you work with us? And we couldn't because we were committed to do Alison Moyet. We were committed to do other stuff. But she would. Can you believe this? I mean, I'm working, with Bananarama, and the tape op saying like, it's Madonna on the phone. I'm going, it's like, she's phoned but 10 times that day. Do you know what I mean? I'm just going, what are we going
to
do?
She's the type that to take for an answer, is she?
Hi, Madonna. Yes, we're still working and everything else. Anyway, in the end, we couldn't do it. And she went off and she worked with, she did Like a Virgin with Steinberg and Kelly. Amazing. And that was the end of that story.
Amazing.
But she, Seymour Stein, I met him and I said, can you believe? After she's massively, can you believe we never got this together? And he went, oh, don't worry. Yeah. He said, you did the Alison Moyet. That was great.
Yeah.
And the thing is that.
And it was.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Madge, bless her soul, she would like turn producers over and writers.
Yeah.
So she would have been, we would have lasted an album. Couple of, and then we'd be like, gone. She would have come to you. And then she would just go. She was smart because you just go to anybody, the right people who have success, and the next thing like William Orbit or anything else. Yeah, so that's that sad story, but
amazing.
But things like opportunities, and when we were having a lot of success, I think that because
were working with everyone, Tony, weren't you?
Well, we were doing diverse stuff and writing, and so people just saw our name. We had four singles in the top 20 and a number one album, things like that.
But producing other bands as well as writing,
And the thing is, so people want to buy into that. They just go, they just phone you up, and go. I mean, there were loads of people phoning and going, we want to work with you. You want to work with you because they saw it as like a passport, as if we were going to make them successful, which didn't happen all the time. Yeah. But it was mad, but great.
Yeah, yeah. Tony, you touched upon working with Alison Moyet earlier on. Tell me, what was that like working with her?
It was an interesting experience, Rick. And Alison is a fantastic singer. And a great person.
Was there pressure on you?
Tons.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, up until then, she'd been in a band. And it was her first solo outing, wasn't it?
Well, she'd been with Vince. And Vince and her are parted. Yeah. I mean, I have to tell you something about Vince, who is absolutely brilliant, but I can never get my head around that he wrote those tracks on a guitar.
Amazing.
As far as I'm concerned, Vince sat with his BBC computer going, or with sequences like you or I do. But he wrote those tracks on the guitar.
Amazing.
But anyway, she was like lost, and she'd gone to Lamont Dozier, and he'd written Invisible for her and produced it and done the recording, but it all went wrong.
Yeah.
Muff Winwood called us up and said, look, I'd really like you to meet Alison and work with her.
Yeah.
And write with her. So we went to Basildon
Is that where she lived?
Yeah. We got the gig and
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Excuse me. We got the gig and we were going to co-write the entire album with her, which we did. So we just set off for Basildon every day. She'd done this massive deal with CBS, the biggest deal that was proposed, you know, that was one of the deals they used to do at that time, which was actually in reality lasted 25 years. Because basically it was a demand for albums. But basically you make an album, you tour. It realistically, it's going to be another couple of years before you make an album. These deals went on and on. And she had it was allegedly at that time, 1984, wasn't it? It was worth $4 million. And that was so pressure.
Yeah.
But anyway, we wrote the tracks and then we started recording them in, say, August, October, September, something like that. We did the single Love Resurrection first.
Yeah.
And I remember I was talking to someone the other day. We decorated the studio for Muff to come down. He hadn't heard a thing. Can you imagine it? and we'd also done on the other track a jazz track called Baby It's You on the B side. And she'd written Welcome Muff and everything. And we played in the B side first. And I could see his face going, oh my God. What have they done? You know, like they've turned her into Ella Fitzgerald. And like, you know, I could see the bubbles of like the 4 million floating away, you know, and the horror of it all. And you know, Muff is one of the greatest A&R men ever. He produced Dire Straits, Sparks. He totally understood and was the bass player with Steve, his brother, in Spencer Davis.
Yeah, wow.
Brilliant guy. Brilliant. And I could see he looked worried. And he just saw these sort of like decorations and everything. And then we played in Love Resurrection. And he went, it's fantastic, you know. So, and it was quite different.
Yeah.
Anyway, the record came out. Helen Terry, who did back vocals in Culture Club, also bought a record out. The press were really cruel about both of them. They wrote awful articles about their size, actually, which is awful.
Yeah.
And Love Resurrection.
Which wouldn't happen these days.
No.
No.
And it stuck at number 13, or 10, I can't remember. Anyway, it was enough, and it was played and played and played, and people loved it. And then we finished, we started to do the rest of the album, and there was pressure. And then I had a phone call, we were coming up to Christmas. I had a phone call from Muff saying, well, how are you getting on? Fine. Yeah, we're doing about halfway through. Yeah, we've done this, we've done that. And he went, okay. I need you to do something. He said, I need this album quickly and I need you to finish it. And I said, well, okay, well, I'll see what we can do. And I said, when? In 2 weeks. That's what he said. And we went, oh my God. But we finished the album, we delivered it, and it was number one for Christmas.
Amazing.
But the stress of it was unreal.
Were you working day and night then for 2 weeks?
And mixing it and trying to get it finished, and doing alternate mixes and things like that. But I mean, look, it sold, I don't know, 5-6 million, so fine. But she allegedly, I mean, this is, I have to be careful what I say. I think now she thinks differently about it, but I think with the pressure, our brief from the record company was very strict. It said Dusty Springfield. We want Dusty Springfield type album.
Yeah.
And I was trying to keep it contemporary because I had lunch with Muff when I'd more or less delivered it and played to him. And he said, there are no solos. You know, there's no guitar solo or sax solo. I said, I know. I said, it's deliberate. I said, there are breakdowns and sections. I said, I said, look, Muff, it's like, here it comes, the sax solo, or here it comes. I said, we don't want, and he went, okay, I get that. And that was it. And, So All Cried Out went to, it peaked at 8. And then Invisible, the Lamont Dozier track, the only track we didn't write, was released. And it went to 24. And I went, oh, my God, it's over. And I got a phone call from Muffs going, the reason it's gone 24, Tony, is because the album is number one. So is it?
So what is that? The third single, fourth single?
Invisible? It was the third single prior to the album release. You see, the point is, people have gone. What it was was that. Yeah, I love Invisible, but I'm going to buy the album.
Yeah,
so I can,
yeah.
The single wasn't an issue really. Yeah. So yeah,
and you hadn't written it anyway, so who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
not thinking like that, but
you're saying that Alf wasn't overly happy with it. Or?
She didn't like the way she'd sung it. Or this is what I'd heard. This is all rumour. I stress, and she listened to the cassette in the car, and I heard that she threw it out the window and hated it.
I think there might have been an element of. The memory of the stress of those last 2 weeks that might have been playing on her mind when she was listening to it. It might have brought back memories, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that it wasn't... It was all about deals, money, pressure.
Yeah.
And the music had taken the back seat, although we delivered it. We'd have managed to deliver it. The sad thing is that we had another album in us and she just didn't want to do it with us. It was like a sort of divorce in a way. It was horrible.
Yeah.
And when you've made someone... You've done a good job with somebody, and there's more left in you. Yeah. We did write with her a track which is under wraps after that, and I've met her since. And you know, it's okay, but there's these things happen.
Yeah, yeah.
People fall out, and that's it. But it really upset me.
Yeah,
it really did, and it threw me. You know, and I thought so. But we went on to do other stuff.
Yeah.
Can you separate then the process of making an album, if that's a particularly stressful time or you know, if that was a difficult time or whatever, from the end product? I mean, obviously, like you said, Rick, it's going to give you a memory or a kind of a bad feeling. The only way I could relate to that is if you did a movie and you can have a horrible time doing a movie, but the movie goes on to be a huge success. Then is that the same for you guys?
Yeah, I don't think you want to listen to it. I can't listen to them sometimes for 6 months after, and then I put it on and go, actually, this isn't bad.
Yeah.
Plus, when you're producing and Rick, you know this, and like yourself, you know, you're scene after scene after scene.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard these tracks 1,000 times.
Yeah, you need some separation.
Yeah, and I don't even know. I think, okay, well, that's it. And when you're so involved with the writing, you've played the parts, and when you come to mix that thing, you've got to go, I spent 2 days doing that overdub, but it actually is rubbish, and take it out. But
getting
I mean,
too it, close to it.
It shocks me, you know, in your business, Jake, that you know the amount of people acting or movie stars and things. They've never even seen the films. They never watched them.
Yeah,
so, you know,
yeah,
they never. They, and I can't get my head around that. You know, they don't want to see them. You know, they don't want to see themselves.
Yeah.
Some actors can't see themselves, can they?
No.
So yeah, I do understand that. Well, I find that slightly weird. I think it's the only way to improve in your craft, and it must be the same in music. You know, you have to listen back. And,
yeah.
I was going to say, how do you know when a song is finished? How do you know when you stop fiddling with it?
You start the day with nothing, a coffee. You talk about the football on television or what's going on or you know, Brexit, a horrible word, or anything, or, you know, had too much to drink last night or cars or anything else. And then you natter, and then you sit down, put the equipment on and you write something, you do a fabulous demo. At the beginning of that day, there was nothing. At the end of that day, there is a song. That is, and do you know
it's
what?
Such a great feeling.
The best thing about that is nobody else has heard it.
Mm.
You're the two people who are privy to it.
Mm.
Then you've got that decision of letting it out the bag. But your question about finishing a song is just you think you have to pick at it. You go and you do it and you go, well, I think we could improve that bit and maybe that bit.
Yeah.
Or someone, middle eights are an art in themselves and can save a song because they're you know, you've got your verse and your bridge and your chorus and the middle eight takes you somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that can really save a song.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell when you do what we do, you can, you know, some of these, the say, for instance, you know, Rihanna or Little Mix or any of these things, they're so crafted in the computer that they couldn't do a lot of this stuff without a computer to pick at each thing, tune it, effects, like that.
Yeah.
And it's making a certain kind of record, which I think in some ways they've lost some of their personality.
Mm.
I feel that some of them artists are indistinguishable from the others.
Mm.
But I have to say that the teenagers sing today, they listen to anything that could be from Bob Dylan to some wild synth stuff. And they get, once they've finished with it, they go on to something else.
Mm.
Singles, you know, singles are back. really. Yeah, you know, not yeah. albums, you know.
What yeah. do you listen to at the moment?
Ben Howard's not a new artist, but I like him. There's a guy called called Rye Cummings, who's under Rye X, and he did a track called Deliverance, which I absolutely love. I wrote to the engineer. It's just the most amazing track. Mm. And he's had tracks in films. I'll be honest with you, I don't love a lot of the new stuff, but I love people who are being inventive and people are doing clever mixes, and there are some brilliant songs around. Mm. I mean, I do, you know, it's interesting how popular Ed Sheeran is for being so diverse. He seems to like, he could do anything and do an R&B track or work with, you know, Steve Mack and do anything, and the public just absorb it. And it's clever huge. Yeah. Shape of you. You know, it's just anything goes. And I think that's to do with the whole sort of on demand situation we're in with social media and everything else. You know, it's like now. Mm. We want something now, we want something different. And I think it's more stimulating, you know. Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and it's interesting how it's all crossed, you know, how it's R&B's crossing the jazz.
Yeah, you work with Bananarama, obviously.
Indeed.
And you wrote a couple of hits for them.
Yeah.
Shy Boy was the original title. Something about Carl. I'll tell you why, because Lee Bennett, who's not with us today, unfortunately, he did a little bit of research on this.
All right.
Okay, he says, I'm told the girls weren't happy to sing a song called Big Red Motorbike, and somehow it morphed into Shy Boy. Can you tell us about that, Tone?
That's interesting. Well, we met.
That's a good question.
It's a good question, isn't it?
So
my big red motorbike.
Yeah. So we were trying to write this track and work on it. We were working on the studio, and Steve had come up with this. The chorus was like the same chords, but he went out in the studio and went, right, okay, I'm going to do this. And he went out there and sang, on your big red motorbike, I was just looking at him, and then he came in full of it, going, "Well," and I said, "It's just crap." I said, "It's so bad that I don't even know what to say." So he looked at me. I think probably a few missiles later, tape
brutal,
box.
Brutal honesty.
Yeah, I won't tell you what I said. I can't tell you what he said. But that was our working relationship. It was all over. You know, it's just like, I think his words were, I'll leave out the swear words, "You come up with something better." From that, we just went, well, you know, it's up. So that's what happened. You've done it, make you feel good. That was it. Yeah. It's like, that's what most Motown things are. That's how that evolved.
Yeah.
They liked it. They came in and, you know, we learned that this wasn't going to be easy. You know, they just ran the mic, three of them together was the best way to record them and then track them up.
Oh, wow.
Not individually. We tried that. That doesn't work. Yeah. They had a blend. It was the sound. It was the hairbrush singing.
Yeah.
The girls in the bedroom singing around Abra. And so we recorded that, and then I mixed it. Well, no, I did an end-of-evening mix. Like, you know, like, whatever, stick it all up. And I went, we listened to Really Saying Something. I remember listening to the studio and going, I said, our track doesn't sound anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, like, engineering-wise, audio-wise.
Yeah.
So I went through the whole desk. Like, all the things were up, and I just went, junk, junk, you know, more middle, more crunch, more crappy echo, more of this, more of that. I put that down on tape as a rough mix.
Yeah.
That's what went out.
Wow.
And that was the story of that, and we went to number four. Couldn't believe it.
Wow, amazing.
And the same bass I used.
Yeah,
same bass again, the old Roland.
Yeah.
But it had a vibe to it.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then what happened then? Oh, we recorded Na Na Hey Hey, Kissing Goodbye. And then... They, without any warning, we don't even know why, they just said, we don't want to work with you anymore. So I just went, well, we're in the middle of doing... And they went to Barry Blue, who did Cheers then, which went to number 46. And then something went down there, I don't know what. So I got a call from, like, can you meet us in the pub?
Who from? Who's
the girls.
From? Yeah.
Can you meet us in the pub? Right. So we're going next door, meet them pub. We want to work with you again. We were going, what the hell? You know, it's just like, what is going on? You don't want to work with us? You want to work with us?
What was the reason?
Don't know. Right. I haven't got a clue to this day. Yeah. And so fortunately, we had a copy of Na Na Hey Hey, a 24-track, and we finished that. And that went to number five.
Yeah.
Then we did Robert De Niro's Waiting, yeah. which was went Huge. To number two. Yeah. Which was, which is, yeah, well, that's when they met yeah. De Niro.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to say either. They just sat in the pub not talking.
Yeah.
So that must have been it. And, you know, then we did yeah. Cruel Summer.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, that was in The Karate Kid. That was brilliant. Yeah, so yeah. they used a 12-inch in The Karate Kid.
Great.
That went to, that was in
it's
American.
It's,
yeah, yeah, an American top, same bass.
Yeah.
That, and that was yeah. a track that Imagination didn't want to do. It was a backtrack. And then, wow. Yeah, so, and that was a big hit for us.
Yeah.
And globally.
Yeah.
And then Ace of Base covered it 10 years later.
Wow.
And made it a hit again.
Yeah.
So you never know.
Amazing.
What's around the corner, so.
Tony, tell me about your, do you have any fond memories of recording the Spandau stuff, like True and Gold and all those amazing tunes that they had?
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Hard, but yeah.
In what way?
Well, we Spandau Ballet were going through a difficult stage.
Yeah.
They'd done, cut a long story short, things, I don't think things were going great for them. Producer-wise, they were working with Trevor Horn.
Yeah.
And Trevor had kept them, you know, more or less imprisoned.
Instinction, I think they did.
Yeah, he did the remix, and then he started new tracks. And I think he was trying to do a bass drum for 2 weeks. Like Trevor
That's
is
hard on anyone. I think.
No disrespect, Trevor. Yeah. I idolise Trevor Horn's work, and he is brilliant. But I think there was some friction here about what's going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I said Spandau Ballet, I'm not sure about that. Really, and then someone said to me, who was working in the office, said, "Yeah, maybe you should reconsider that." So we went to a rehearsal room to see them, you know, playing some of the new stuff. And we were so taken aback by their sheer enthusiasm, and like, you know, we're very much alive, even though we may be struggling a bit with chart positions and that, you know. So that was it. And then we did one track with them as a sort of let's see how we get on. Lifeline.
Yeah.
And that was a hit.
Great.
So it was like number seven. And then they asked us to do the True album, which they wanted to do in the Bahamas. So we all set off to the Bahamas, and which was sounds fabulous, but it was 3 weeks being locked in a room with no windows for me. And, you know, there's obviously footage online of it and everything else. It was an experience. Amazing. And it was great. But you don't know that. What's going to happen? You never know. You know, we worked on tracks. You don't know it's going to be a hit.
No,
until
no. Did you feel that True was going to be as big as it was when you were recording it?
No. I knew that some of the tracks were good. Like Gold was on that album, you see.
You must have felt that was going to be a
Yeah, and it was like... But we did a lot of recording there, and then we brought the tapes back, and then we carried on working on them in the UK, and that was mixed at Redbus, a lot of that, and Summer Odyssey. But the first singles came out, and from that album, they did pretty well, following Lifeline.
Yeah.
And then I had a phone call that and True was 6.5 minutes long. And I had a phone call, and they said, "We want to release True." And I went, "Oh my God." I went back in the studio, I took the master, and I cut it and I cooked it. You know, I put it through compressors, through the desk. I just said, "Why don't we put the chorus at the front to that, not for the radio, it was like that on the album.
Yeah.
Because this is a big thing of mine through all the work I've done, is listen to what you got. If you often with records, you go, "I love that bit in the middle," and you can't wait to get to it. "I love that bit." And I just said, "Right, wait 2 minutes? Yeah. Stick that at the front, whatever it is, or break it down, or, you know, take that backing vocal you love and stick it." So I did.
Yeah.
And that's what it was.
So after you've mixed True, you must have had some kind of buzz on that, thinking this is something special.
Do you know, the thing about it now is that it still gets played a lot, but it's not dated badly.
Right.
I mean, people either love Tony Hadley or they don't. I mean, it took 5 days to do that lead vocal.
Wow.
And that's not a criticism of Tony. Mm. It's just that it was a difficult vocal to do.
Yeah.
And he delivered. I can't think of anybody else singing that track. You know, it's just like...
Do you know what? We watched Tony sing it the other night, didn't we? A night for Christina, Kenny Thomas's daughter, poorly. And we watched Tony sing that. And his vocal, we were all saying... No one can sing it like Tony.
No.
Tony, that is his song.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one can sing it like him.
Well, it's like the plays on it. Even there, it's over 5 million plays in America.
Yeah.
I mean, sadly, I didn't write it. You know, but the thing is, but you know, it's also, I think, from a sort of an analytical producer point of view.
Yeah.
We used an instrument called made by Rhodes called the Rhodes Chroma, and that was a synth. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was a big thing, but the bass was played on that. So right. Basically, it's got a synthetic R&B bass on it.
Yeah.
So I think, and also the R&B sampling, I think it's all connected with that simplicity yeah. of that and why it hasn't dated.
Yeah.
I think those are elements. Plus, the real hook of that track is the back vocals.
Yes.
That's Gary Kemp singing those, yeah. you know. So,
because Gary's got a great voice. I remember one of the Sods dudes, he got up and sung True acoustically.
Yeah.
And he sung it beautifully.
Yeah.
It was a lovely performance.
Yeah. And because it gets used in a lot of movies and syncs.
Yeah. It's ubiquitous.
Yeah.
As is gold.
Yeah.
A gold, like every Olympics.
Yeah.
Sorted.
Yeah.
What a great idea for a lyric.
Well, there's also a hidden thing in there, really, because Duran Duran Spandau Ballet were kind of like a bit of arch enemies, really.
Yeah.
And Duran Duran, of course, got a Bond movie. And this really...
Yes.
That really...
Irked
Gary, I think. So hence, you know...
Yeah.
And plus, encouraged by me, that's why the middle section is Bond, isn't it? You know,
Bongos.
It's a Bond track, really.
Yeah, it is. But again, that still sounds timeless as well, Tony. I've got to say, mate, the production on those tracks were just... It was just so clean, and everything was beautiful.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you.
Especially, I thought, you know.
Well, it's also... I think it's an uncluttered approach. Sometimes yes. I go cluttered, but the thing is that I think that had come from the imagination. I like, you know, it's using the reverbs properly and that, you know. And I tell you what, on True, we were talking about, Frank Sinatra. Mm. I was fascinated by the Americans. Tony Bennett is a great example of this. And then George Michael used this same technique. Of the echo they use, reverb, which is using with a thing called pre-delay, and what they do is they delayed it with tape, so you get nothing, and the echo slaps back. There would be the S's sort of take off. You know, it's like you know, I left my heart in San Fran.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
And I
used to listen to this and I go, I really like that, and that's what I used to use on his voice, and on the mixes. A lot of people do mixes and don't move the reverb. I would ride the sends on the reverb all the time, sending each at the end of the lines, into echo.
Yeah, yeah,
because it...
What were you using? Was that a lexicon? Or
yeah, that was a lexicon, I think. Yeah. And the it brings it alive.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's I think that's... I like the combination from my own satisfaction of being able to, you know, to like yourself, to do the engineering and the production. And you can go, oh, we could do this and we could do that. Although it's nice to sit back and let somebody else do all the computer work, because it's quite exhausting. But
what's your favourite experience? Is it writing or producing?
I like... My least favourite experience is vocals, because they're... Not because I don't love working with the people, it's because I've been asked about this before. You cannot, you know, it's a psychotherapy job. All you can do is put somebody at ease. They've got the confidence and the voice that they walk in that studio with, and they're going to deliver or they're not going to deliver. And some vocalists come in, you know, even though they're known nervous, they've got, you know, four lemons, honey thing, a suitcase full of lucky, and you just, that's all you can do.
Nerves is a big thing.
Do you think most artists are that way in your experience?
I would say, my experience.
Yeah, no criticism to them. I wouldn't, you know, doing a lead vocal and singing with headphones on is a really difficult thing to do right. Mm. Yeah. And the thing is, in pitch and harmony and all that stuff.
And it's such a different experience to singing it live in front of an audience. If you've got an audience there and you're singing to someone, you're seeing people's reaction as you sing, and that makes you do stuff that you wouldn't normally do. In a studio, you've got your headphones on, you've got a microphone in front of you, and just a load of grey material that's deadening the sound. And it's like so synthetic. It's that there's no, yeah. there's no.
The
real
only inspiration kind of... is like they look through the window and see you or me.
Yeah,
and chance,
with our feet
chance,
up, yeah, reading a book.
Chances are we're having soup,
yeah,
or a yogurt, talking.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, like oh, yeah, yeah, and not paying any attention.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is, it's a long process doing a lead vocal. Yeah. Sometimes people come in and it's just like, oh my God, you know, they're just like one take.
It's a funny thing recording it with Kim, because Kim will come into my home studio where we are at the moment, and Kim will sit in front of the mic and she's literally sitting right next to me and we're discussing the melodies and the phrasing and lyrics even. Sometimes she'll sing a lyric and for whatever reason you just feel that it's not feeling comfortable, so sometimes you're even changing lyrics. And then we've gone into somewhere like Rack and you're in these beautiful surroundings and you're in the big studio, and then she'll sing it, and 99% of the time the original vocal that we did in my studio is the one that we keep, because she's just, it's so relaxed and it's just so,
yeah, but you've got an emotional connection as well, you know, understanding what you're trying to create together, and I think yeah, that would be great as an artist to know that you've got that support, that you're working collaboratively in it, as opposed to sticking you in a box and saying, right, come on, come up with something.
Yeah,
I mean, I've tried. I mean, I don't sing really. And the thing is that I've tried, and having recorded some incredible singing, you know, sometimes you're doing a demo, you think, oh, just toss this demo, and you use auto-tune, and it's an out-of-body experience for me. I just can't believe how difficult it is, you know. And the thing is, it doesn't seem like, you just think, oh, well, I'm going to sing this bit and do that. But it's like, and I listen to it, I think, oh, God, you know, nobody's going to hear this. But, I mean, for you, do you, you said you don't, you know, when you're acting, you don't look at yourself much or anything else.
Oh, no, I'm quite happy watching stuff back,
When you're doing it, that process of the performance, and, you know, having been a camera, I know the cameras are here and they're here and there's a lot of bustle behind you. Does that, you just like in the zone?
Yeah, you just have to zone that out, and it's part of the job, yeah.
Because quite pressure, the turnover is quite pressured, isn't it?
It's on EastEnders, it's very high turnover. But I think you just get into that, you get into a rhythm of doing it. It's kind of, it's very theatrical, EastEnders. Like if you've got a 10-page scene, they'll do it in one, because you've got four cameras, because it's multi-camera, it's very quick. So you'll do 10 scenes in one go. So it's like theatre, really.
And they live cut it, don't they? Live, vision mix it.
They'll have a version of it. Yeah, it goes straight off. They'll have a cut version straight away. Yeah.
There's many analogies, actually, with recording a vocal with a live audience and then recording in the studio. Theater. It's like theatre and recording.
To do comedy on TV is very hard if you haven't got an audience, because it's hard to gauge what... Because you're never going to know, are you?
But
if you've got an audience there, then... I remember doing Red Dwarf. They stood Red Dwarf in front of 1,000 audience members, and of course, you know what's funny then. Don't you?
Do you do theatre and stuff?
I did. Yeah, I grew up doing theatre, and I haven't done theatre for years and years.
So. Did you like that?
Yeah, it's a great place to learn your craft, and because you get to go over every night, you get to refine and hopefully perfect. Because, by the end of the run, hopefully, you know exactly what's going to work. And that's working at that moment, and that works then. So that's a nice...
But I guess EastEnders is slightly different, because you're having to learn those scripts almost daily, don't you? So you go in, and then you're learning it, and then performing it immediately.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
incredible pressure and turnover.
Yeah, it's like cramming for exams.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, interesting what we're talking about vocalists, is that... If a lead vocalist is in, then they're only, the producer's encouraging them, and they're only bouncing off there. But it's funny, because a lot of times they're isolated in an isolated room.
Yes,
And the thing is, like, at least you're bouncing off other actors, and they give, don't you? That's one thing people I've talked to other actors that, if you work with so-and-so, they give, you bounce off them.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, there's an interaction there.
Yeah. Chemistry.
Yeah.
I was going to ask. What's the song you're most proud of?
Ah, wow.
That's going to be a hard question.
Yeah, I think one of the Alison Moyet tracks. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that either Love Resurrection or Cried Out. Yeah.
I've heard you sing that one of the sods do.
I thought you'd forget.
And just you playing piano, and that proves what a great song it was.
I mean, when I was King Sod, the chairman of that year, it was the turnout was something else on the ladies' night, because Elmer Bernstein, the film composer, turned up. The guy from Bjorn from ABBA, who never comes, turned up. And it was like, and I had to play.
Of course.
And it was like, I've talked about this experience. And you know, it's strange. If you asked me to play any of my songs now, I'd probably struggle.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, I'd have to go away and think, right, what are the chords? And I'd written a sheet out with the lyrics, and I thought, I'm not... But it was like...
Pressure.
Well, you know, like, sort of stage nerves and things like that. It was like, I remember sitting at the piano and, like, the sort of, like... You know, my hands were like there, and they were like, you know, it's like, no, I
and
can't
the moment
do this.
You start thinking about it, it's that's when you start making the mistakes, isn't it?
Yes.
You're so paranoid about not making a mistake. Of course, you're making, you know.
And the lyrics as well, you know, I was just thinking that, and I thought, you know, when you're changing chords, and you've done it 1,000 times before, but your hands seem to take off, and you think, are they going to make it to the right chord, or are they just going to embarrass me?
Yeah.
You know, and
it's
of course,
horrible,
it's all about muscle memory. Just like, I mean, you do a lot of live work, and I've never loved doing live work. I was in a band and just well, that's probably because one experience is when I fell off stage with my Fender Rhodes. So that's probably, you know, that's not great, is
that
it?
That leaves a scar.
It does, yeah. In more ways than one.
I've done that a few times.
It's not good, is it?
And
you haven't even had a drink.
Look.
You know, it's just a bad stage, you know.
Yeah.
Or one leg's gone off, you know.
Yeah, monitors on stage, always a bad thing for me, though.
Yeah.
That's why we work on in-ears now, so I don't have that problem anymore. But I have fallen over a few in the past. The industry, it's obviously changed a lot from when we were working together back in 86. Do you think it's changed for the better?
It would be really bad, I think. You know, I think the tendency is like you look back and you go, well, it was great. We had a great time. We were in a great period of electronic innovation. Fair lights.
Yeah.
Everything was exciting.
Yeah.
Records were selling. You know, a single would do 450, 500,000 copies, you know, or even a bad one would do 200 or something.
Yeah.
And you could make a living.
Yeah.
But I think that it's just changed. And live is big money, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, for the big bands, but that's hard. And it's another form of income.
So bearing that in mind, Tony, what advice would you give to any young aspiring writer or producer?
Wow. Well, I think the advice I give is if that's what you want to do, you should keep doing it. You might, if you're struggling with money, a job on the side is a good idea, even if it's in music or like working in a venue or anything, or working in a studio, or they're difficult.
A second trade.
Yeah, because the thing is, otherwise you start getting depressed.
Yeah.
Work with someone else. That's because the someone else is going to keep you going. It's support.
Yeah.
Don't give up. I mean, the thing is, if you love doing it, do it. You know, don't be put off, because it's a passion that will never leave you. And the most important thing is to do it for yourself.
Well, I was going to say, if you're doing it for money, you're probably doing it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, we didn't. We never did it for money.
No.
No, did we?
No.
And the thing is, we did it because...
It's a passion.
It's a passion.
And that's still is.
Yeah, the more you do it, the better you become. No one can teach you songwriting.
No.
But the thing is to be truthful to yourself. And because, you know, you will deliver your best work.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I cracked it because of that one thing, really, because I thought, no, I want to do it like this. This is how I feel. This is what moves me. And the thing is that that's a vision. If you just copy stuff, you know, you've got to remember that anything you listen to now was made a year ago. You know, so if you start making that stuff, you're going to be 2 years out of date.
Yeah, yeah.
So the thing is to think ahead. You stuck with it for years and years, and I've stuck with it, and we've, you know, we've had a good run, and I still love doing it. You know, and it's not got any easier.
Yeah,
that's for sure. But
it still astounds me that I can still put an album on and get blown away. That never ceases to amaze me. I was listening to a band called Bon Iver on the plane on the way back from Denmark yesterday. And listening to the whole album right the way through, it absolutely astonished me how fresh and different, after everything that's been released over all these years, and you can still make something sound so different.
Totally.
It just shows that it can be done, and it gives me hope that you can still make something a bit special.
it's like watching what's coming out, whether it's Killing Eve, which is very different. You know, it's all personal. I mean, Years and Years, which is a new series, I think is just, you know, really interesting. It's a real comment, and it's been done very cleverly.
Tony, I just want to thank you so much for coming down. And
pleasure.
I've found this chat absolutely amazing, and I've loved it.
Oh, well, listen, I've enjoyed every minute to talking to both of you, because it's great, and it's a, you know, it's Jake's in a different profession to us, and I find that fascinating as well.
Yeah.
And the thing is that...
Well, it's down to Jake.
We all love what we do.
It's down to Jake that we're actually here, because Jake mentioned to me about starting a podcast a couple of years ago, and I said, yeah. And you know what I'm like, Tony, I need to kick up the arse, and Jakey did that. And he said, come on, we'll do it together. And it's kind of through Jakey that we're doing this.
That's great. Yeah,
no, and, but for me, it's fascinating to sit in here. You guys talk. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about half the time in terms of the technical aspects of it, but you know, I really do find it fascinating. And
I think it's important, because we get wrapped up. You know, it's the jigsaw and the nuts and bolts of making records.
Yeah.
And our job is to deliver hits.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes we try and it doesn't work. But the thing is that's it.
Yeah.
I can't tell you the number of people who came up to me and I went, okay, that's great. You know, Body Talk. They said, yeah, we made love to that last night. Yeah. I went, thank you.
That's a little bit too much information.
Yeah, we only got up to the middle eight. Because we were listening to the long version. Yeah, too much information.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us,
pleasure.
Mate.
It's been a fascinating talk.
I never cease to be amazed at your stories, and I know there's so many more that I'd love to get out of you. Listen, and hopefully one day we'll do it again.
Yeah, no, it'll be great, and it's always great to see you. And the thing is, you know, we've done an album together,
yeah.
And it turned out fantastically.
Yeah,
and I still, you know, love those tracks. It was a big success for Kim. What other blessing for our friendship could that be?
Yeah.
Because it was. You know,
it was a beautiful process and a beautiful album. And every time I hear it, I've got nothing but wonderful memories. So
yeah, and you're look what you're doing. You're still here. You're still making records. Kim's still great, and that's it. You know, I mean,
banging them out.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jake, as well.
And,
thank you.
Yeah, it's been a lovely chat. And so, thanks.
Thanks.
Unsung Heroes.
Wow, Tony Swain. Fantastic chat. I know Jake and I were absolutely blown away. It's always lovely to see Tony. We share so many lovely memories of recording the Close album. And it's just great to see him. Thank you so much for listening in. And I really hope that you can join us next week where we speak to some more legends. Lots of love to you all. Take care. Bye.
You have been listening to Unsung Heroes with me, Ricky Wilde, Jake Wood and Lee Bennett. Produced and created by myself and Jake Wood for Wildwood Productions. With music and editing, again by myself, Ricky Wilde. Artwork by Scarlet Wilde and hosted by Acast. Just to remind you that there is a link in the notes directing you to a Spotify playlist featuring all the songs we have discussed in this episode. Many thanks for listening.
Unsung Heroes.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.